There was the BBC Light programme, of course, with its tightly rationed amount of pop music. I suppose the programme Saturday Club was the longest single bout of it at any one time, supplemented by various live lunch hour programmes during the week. If you wanted any more than that, you had to tune into Radio Luxembourg, and in those days they also had programmes as such, some as short as 15 minutes. But in effect, that station was also just as tightly rationed because you could only get it during the evenings. So it was interesting to read in one of the Sunday newspapers at the time a tiny little bit which said something like a ship had anchored somewhere off the southeast coast of England and was broadcasting radio programmes from outside territorial limits. Hours and hours of pop music, no less. So an immediate rush to the radio, tune in, and there it was, Radio Caroline on 199. I suppose Radio Caroline will forever be synonymous with the term pirate radio, but I think that the station that really made the breakthrough and really showed how things could go was Big L, Radio London on 266. I think that was the station that introduced most people in this country to top 40 radio, format radio, and the first time any of us really heard a complete customised jingle package. I think that showed the shape of things to come. Obviously, other stations began to come on the air, and one was always tuning in to see what was new and seeing how many stations you could receive. And I developed such an interest that I'd got various bits and pieces of equipment together so that I was able to make some sort of programmes of my own at home. And I remember, again on a Sunday, tuning in and hearing a new station, which was Radio 270, and that was located just off Scarborough. It covered the northeast of England and, to a certain extent, Scotland. And I remember listening to this station and thinking, well, it just suddenly came to me that I'd like to send a tape up and see if I could get a job, because suddenly jobs in radio were becoming available, and it just suddenly hit me that that this was a reality. So on that same Sunday, I just knocked a quick tape together and actually got it in the post the very same day. And about a week later, I had a letter back from a guy named Noel Miller, who was an Australian. He was the programme controller, saying that they hadn't got a vacancy. He liked the tape, and if anything did come up, he'd probably write again. Well, about another week went by, and I had this telegram saying, ring this number in Scarborough, which I did, and it was Noel Miller's wife on the phone saying, can you come up? We want to interview you. So I immediately sort of dropped everything and dashed off up to Scarborough. And I had to find this this house in the suburbs of Scarborough, which belonged to a guy named Wilf Proudfoot, who was the managing director of Radio 270. He was he had been an MP, and indeed after Pirate Radio became an MP again. But his business was running a chain of supermarkets in and around Scarborough. And I can remember sitting in the typing area, because he had his office, ran his business from an extension built onto his house. I remember just sitting there all nervous, and this fellow walked in and said, what's your name then? And I told him who I was, and he said, oh, and he disappeared off into his office, and then I was told that that was Wilf Proudfoot. Anyway, Noel Miller eventually arrived. He'd been out selling or something. And it took me into another room and asked me to read various things out. It was sort of a semi-proper audition. Imagine this this candlestick as the microphone and all this sort of thing. Anyway, I seemed to get through that somehow. And he said, right, when can you start? So it took me about a week to go back home and pack my job in and get some things together and then move off up to Scarborough. In fact, the day that I got up to Scarborough, arrived on the train, I had to change about twice, get to Scarborough, met at the station, lunch, then straight down to the harbour and onto this small fishing boat, and out we went. And it was very strange, I can remember, sort of going to the seaside, and I wasn't on holiday, I can always remember that, going down to the harbour on this beautiful sunny day, and the place was crowded with holidaymakers, and there I was, getting onto this small boat and going out into this beautiful sea, which looked a bit rough actually, and in fact it was. And I was wondering about seasickness, because I was one of those people who'd never been out onto the sea except for a boat trip. In fact, I think the farthest I ever went was on the ferry to the Isle of Wight. But suddenly just coming from an ordinary sort of office job and then going straight onto the sea like that. And I can remember being sick on the way out to Radio 270's ship, the Ocean 7. And I thought, well, this is a good start. And of course, some of the crew were laughing and all everybody and nobody else was being sick except me. Eventually get out to the boat and they say, oh, if it had been another 10 minutes later, this boat, we wouldn't have gone out because it had been too rough. I thought, oh, well, that doesn't make me feel any better. I got onto the boat, there it was, and I remember sitting on the deck for about an hour in this sunshine, and I wasn't particularly interested in the weather at that time. But get down below, don't eat a thing, and I'm there, and had a terrible night, obviously, thinking, what the hell have I let myself in for here? I'm stuck out here now for days because the tender won't be out again. So next morning, just sort of coming round, and the station's already on the air, and I'm feeling like death. And then there's this horrible grinding noise and a loud thud, and everybody leaps up. And some people run up on the deck. And the mast of the ship had broken at the base. 157 feet of it had broken at the base, and it was just being held up by all these metal stays. It was wobbling about. So I thought, this is an excellent start, this is, you know. First day, and the station is off the air. So down we go from Scarborough to Bridlington to get the shelter of Flamborough Head, and there's all sorts of repairs done there. I come off again. I'm taken off again. I don't really know why, but anyway, we came off because I think it was a crew change at the time as well, and they hadn't finished the repairs. I think it had also done some damage to the transmitter as well. So another week later, to mulling around Scarborough, back out we go, and I'm on there then for a fortnight. And eventually I sort of begin to enjoy it a little bit, because for most of the time I seem to be sick. And for some reason I'm given the breakfast show, which is most amazing. Getting up early in the morning, feeling terrible, and going in to a studio, in a tiny sort of little studio, and supposed to sound happy. I'm never at my best in the mornings on land, let alone on sea. Trying to sound happy, and as soon as the microphone's switched off, sticking your head in a bucket. I must have been mad. But it was an experience. It's one of those experiences that you look back on and you say, yeah, I'm glad I went through it, but I wouldn't go through it again. It was one of those things where if it hadn't been for a radio station, you wouldn't have got me near that boat. The Ocean 7 was a converted Dutch lugger. It was built just before the Second World War. And it seemed to be the type of boat that was designed to go over the waves rather than through them. So it meant that even when a slight sea was running, it was rolling and swaying about all the time. But eventually you managed to get sort of used to it. You sort of fought a draw. Another thing I can remember when I was adjusted to it was to stand on the deck and look up at the stars. If I was feeling ill, the stars were still and the boat was moving. But when I was all right and adjusted, you could look up and the stars, no matter how hard you concentrated, it was the stars that were moving, not the boat. So that's when I was really adjusted to it. There were many problems to contend with. One of them was the lack of communication with the shore. Another was the bad weather preventing the tender coming out with food and water, and also so that you could get off the ship and take a break. You could be stuck on the ship for days longer than you were supposed to have been out there, which didn't do that much for morale. And also, of course, the weather really made things very hairy at times. I can remember doing a breakfast programme when it started to blow really strong. And although we had the turntables mounted on gimbals, which took into account the movement of the ship, what it didn't take into account was the fact when the ship was hit by a large wave and moved quite a bit to the side, it meant that the pickup arms used to stand up vertically and then slam down on the records again, which didn't exactly do that much for your program. And on that particular morning, I can remember I played more than once. I played three records in a row because I was just so ill. It was just all I could do was just to cue the records up and let them play. It was impossible for me to speak. And as the day went on, it got rougher and rougher. In fact, we had to abandon the news service. For one thing, the typewriter had come off a table and gone through a wall of the office. And things were all over the floor. There were tapes all over the floor, records all over the floor. We had to actually abandon playing records. The pickup arms just would not stay on the record. And we had to play tapes, broadcast tapes. And eventually, as the evening came, it became so rough, and the noise was really frightening. People were walking around in life jackets, actually. We had to up the anchor ages before that, actually, because on that ship you just didn't stay at anchor when the weather started to blow. You had to up the anchor and steam into it. And we'd had some problems with the engine about a week before, and we were wondering what was going to happen if the engine failed at this particular moment, or, in fact, what would happen if the mast broke. Because the very first night I spent on Radio 270, that very next morning, the mast had broken at the base and was only held up by stays, and it was wobbling all over the place. But we got that repaired. But it was always a thought, what happens if it goes again? What happens if it goes now in the middle of this terrible gale? But it didn't. But eventually there was a tremendous wave which sounded like a couple of lorry loads of bricks being dropped on the deck. The ship went right over onto one side. People were falling about, and it just seemed to stay there. The lights went up and down. Water started to pour in. Water came into the studio, and there were sparks everywhere. And eventually it managed to right itself, but it put the transmitter off. We were off the air. The people listening to us on land at the office wondered what on earth was going on. They were terrified. They thought we'd had it. We thought we'd had it as well, especially when an experienced captain of about 30 years' experience sort of came in and said, in all seriousness, lads, I don't think we're going to make it. But we did. We did. And after that, I came off the ship because, quite frankly, I just couldn't stand any more of that. It was sad when the Marine Offences Bill became law, hearing what had become so many familiar stations closing down for the last time. In fact, I was quite angry and idealistic about it, and I remember making not the slightest attempt to join what I considered at the time to be the two-faced stampede to get on the BBC. You know, lots of people slagging the BBC, and next minute they turn up on it. But despite all the hassles, looking back now, I enjoyed being a pirate disc jockey. You felt as if you were somebody. It's not like years later when almost everybody you bump into happens to be running a disco or is into hospital radio or something. You felt as if you were famous even if you weren't. As can be easily imagined, pirate radio had its share of highly individual people, its characters. There was always something going on, especially with so many strong and exuberant personalities all crammed together in the confines of a radio ship. Practical jokes were rampant. It was a common occurrence, for instance, to be reading a commercial out or reading the news and at the same time having cold seawater poured down the back of your neck. Or, again, a couple of things that come to mind. We used to have some trouble with the transmitter. From time to time, it became intermittent for various reasons. And I remember this one occasion where we did actually go off the air, but the guy in the studio didn't know about it. So Neddy Noel, chief jock, ran straight into the studio while this guy was speaking and let loose with a whole load of shouted obscenities and things. And, of course, this guy thought it was actually going over the air, and he was quite shocked. I suppose it would have been quite a historic broadcast had the transmitter suddenly switched itself back on again. But there you are. They managed to get Neddy back for that because we had one of those vacuum cleaners with the long tubes on, the type of cleaner that could blow as well as suck. And somehow or other, the pipes got full of flour, and the end of the pipe was placed in the studio in front of Neddy Noel, but where he couldn't see it properly and didn't know what it was, didn't notice it. And they waited until he started to speak on the air and the vacuum cleaner was switched on. and the studio was filled with flour. Most of it went over Neddy Noel, and after that we had about an hour of continuous music while the place was cleaned up and people were threatened with the sack. Obviously, to remain within the law, or to remain outside the law, depending on which way you look at it, 270 had to broadcast outside of the three-mile limit, as it was then. But it wasn't unknown for the ship to come well within that limit at the dead of night with the transmitter switched off, simply to fill up with fresh water from a tap on the quayside at Scarborough Harbour. And there was an occasion, I believe, I wasn't actually on duty on the ship at the time, when the customs came down. It was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and various other people, and wanted to see the ship's papers, and nobody could find them, not even the papers for the last port of call. So I think the police were called, and as they were arriving, the ship cast off and went outside again. One of the reasons we used to have to come inside the three-mile limit was when we had a major breakdown, either of the engines or the transmitter. And I remember one occasion where we were in the harbour and repairs were being carried out, and there was a guy right at the top of the mast, all 150-odd feet of it, doing some repairs to the aerial. And the crew had been drinking, and they'd heard that it was all right to go out again, but there was still this guy at the top of the mast. Well, off they set from Scarborough and went out, and this guy's still at the top. And you can imagine when the ship rolls, that when you're 150-odd foot up in the air, it's quite a movement at the very top of the mast, and he was trapped up there and had to drop spanners onto the deck to attract people down there, and they eventually realised he was up there and they had to go up and get him down. Another thing that happened after a breakdown was we'd got the part, the transmitter was all working again, and we were ready to go on the air first thing next morning. It was the member of the crew who was on night watch to wake up the first guy in the morning, and that was me that particular morning. And everybody went to sleep, really, and we were supposed to start at 6 o'clock, and I think we started at 8:30. Things like that could always happen in pirate radio.